Richard let out a heavy breath. It's a terrible thing to have to kill someone like that, someone you know. I believe the alternative is worse.
The alternative?
A man asked. Yes, letting them murder me. That's the alternative, losing your life and losing the cause for which you fight, the lives of your loved ones. Richard's expression had turned grave. If some of your people have joined with the Order or worked to protect them, then it may be that you could end up facing them. It will be their life or yours. It could even mean the lives of the rest of us. If they side with evil, then we must not allow them to stop us from eliminating evil. This is part of what you must weigh in your decision to join us or not. If you take up this struggle, you must accept that you may have to kill people you know. You must weigh this in the choice you will make. The men no longer seemed shocked by his words. They looked solemn as they listened. Kalin saw small birds flitting past, looking to roost for the night. The sky, the icy fog, was getting darker. She scanned the sky, ever watchful for black-tipped races. With the weather in the past so dreadful, she doubted they would be around. The fog, at least, was comforting for that reason. Richard looked exhausted. She knew how hard it was for her to breathe in the high, thin air, so it had to be far worse for him. She feared how, because of the poison, the thin air robbed Richard of his strength. They needed to be down out of the high pass. "I have told you the truth and all I can for now," Richard told the men. "Your future is now up to each of you." He quietly asked Kara, Jensen, and Tom to collect their things. He put a gentle hand on Kalin's back as he turned to the man and gestured down the hill. "We are going back down to our camp in those woods. You men decide what you will do. If you are with us, then come down there in the protection of the trees, where the races won't be able to spot us when the weather lifts. We will need to finish making the weapons you will carry. If any of you choose not to join us, then you're on your own. I plan not to be here at this camp for long. If the Order captures you, they will likely torture you, and I don't want to be anywhere nearby when you scream your lungs out as you reveal where our camp was." The forlorn men stood huddled in a group.
"Lord Rawl," Owen asked, "you mean we must choose now?"
"I've told you all I can. How much longer can those being tortured, raped, and murdered wait for you? If you wish to join us and be part of life, then come down to our camp. If you choose not to be on our side, then I wish you luck. But please don't try to follow us, or I'll have to kill you. I was once a woods guide. I will know if any of you follow us." One of the men, the one who had been the first to show Richard two pebbles to say that he would reveal the location of the antidote, stepped forward, away from the rest of the men.
"Lord Rawl, my name is Anson." Tears filled his blue eyes. "I wanted you to know that, to know who I am. I am Anson."
Richard nodded. "All right, Anson.
Thank you for opening my eyes. I've always had some of the thoughts that you explained. Now I understand why, and I understand the darkness kept over my eyes. I don't want to live like that anymore. I don't want to live by words that don't mean anything, and I don't want the men of the Order to control my life. My parents were murdered. I saw my father's body hanging from a pole. He never hurt anyone. He did nothing to deserve such a murder. My sister was taken. I know what those men are doing to her. I can't sleep at night thinking about it, thinking about her terror. I want to fight back. I want to kill these evil men. They've earned death. I want to grind them into dust, as you have said. I choose to join with you and fight to gain my freedom. I want to live free. I want those I love to live free."
Kalin was stunned to hear one of them say such things, especially without first consulting with the rest of the men. She had watched the eyes of the other men as Anson spoke. They all listened keenly to everything Anson said. Richard smiled as he placed a hand on the young man's shoulder. "Welcome to Dahara, Anson. Welcome home. We can use your help." He pointed off at Kara and Tom picking up the weapons they'd brought to show the men. "Why don't you help them take those things back down to our camp?" Anson grinned his agreement. The soft-spoken young man had broad shoulders and a thickly muscled neck. He was genial, but looked determined.
If she were in the Imperial Order, Kaelin would not want to see such a powerfully built man coming after her. Anson eagerly tried to take the load from Kara's arms. She wouldn't relinquish it, so he picked up the rest of the things and followed Tom down the hill. Jensen went along too, pulling Betty behind her by a rope, tugging for the first few steps because Betty wanted them to stay with Richard and Kaelin. The other men watched as Anson started down the hill with Kara, Tom, and Jensen. They then moved off to the side, away from the statue, while they whispered among themselves, deciding what they would do. Richard glanced at the figure of Kaja Rang before starting down the hill. Something seemed to catch his eye. "What's the matter?" Kaelin asked. Richard pointed, that writing, on the face of the pedestal below his feet. Kaelin knew there had been no writing on that spot before, and she was still too far away to really tell if she could see writing in the flecked granite. She glanced back to see the others making their way down the hill, but instead followed Richard when he started toward the statue. The men were still off to the side, busily engaged in their discussion. She could see the spot on the face of the pedestal where the warning beacon had shattered. The sand from inside the statue, representing Richard, was still splattered across the face of the pedestal. As they got closer, she could hardly believe what she was beginning to see. It looked as if the sand had eroded the stone to reveal lettering. The words had not been there before, that much she was sure of. Kaelin knew a number of languages, but she didn't know this one. She recognized it, though. It was High Dahauran. She hugged her arms to herself in the chill wind that had come up. The somber clouds stirred restlessly. She peered around at the imposing mountains, many hidden by a dark shroud of fog. Swirling curtains of snow obscured other slopes in the distance. Through a small, brief opening in the wretched weather, the valley she could see off through the pass offered the promise of green and warmth. And the Imperial Order. Kaelin, close beside Richard, wished he would put a warm arm around her. She watched as he stared at the faint letters in the stone. He was being far too quiet for her peace of mind.
"Richard?"
she whispered, leaning close to him.
"What does it say?"
Transfixed, he ran his fingers slowly, lightly, over the letters, his lips soundlessly pronouncing the High Dahauran words.
"Wizard's Eighth Rule," Richard whispered in translation. "Talga Vasternish."
Chapter 46. Following behind the messenger, Verna stepped aside as a tight pack of horses raced by. Their bellies were caked with mud, their nostrils flared with excitement. The eyes of the cavalry soldiers bent over their withers showed grim determination. With the constant level of activity of recent weeks, she had to maintain a careful vigil whenever she stepped out of a tent, lest she be run down by one thing or another. If it wasn't horses charging through camp, it was men at a run.
"Just up ahead,"
the messenger said over his shoulder. Verna nodded to his young face as he glanced back. He was a polite young man. His curly blonde hair and his mannerly behavior combined to remind her of Warren. She was defenseless against the wave of pain that cut through her with the memory of Warren being gone at the emptiness of each day. She couldn't remember this messenger's name. There were so many young men. It was hard to recall all their names. Though she tried her best, she couldn't keep track of them. At least for a while now, they hadn't been dying at a terrifying rate. As harsh as the winters were up in Dahara, such weather had at least been a respite from the battles of the previous summer, from the constant fighting and dying. With summer again upon them, she didn't think that the relative quiet was going to last much longer. For now, the passes held against the Imperial Order. In such narrow and confined places, the enemy's weight of numbers didn't mean so much. If only one man would fit through a narrow hole in a stone wall, it meant little that there were 100 waiting behind him to go through, or 1,000. Defending against one man, as it were, was not the impossible task that it was, trying to fight the onslaught of Jigang's entire force. When she heard the distant thunder, felt it rolling through the ground, she glanced up at the sky. The sun had not made an appearance in 2 days. She didn't like the looks of the clouds building against the slopes of the mountains.
it looked like they could be in for a nasty storm. The sound might not have been thunder. It was possible that it was the magic the enemy hammered against the shields across the passes. Such battering would do them no good, but it made for uneasy sleeping, so if for no other reason, they kept at it. Some of the men and the officers passing in the other direction gave her a nod in greeting or a smile or a small wave. Verna didn't see any Sisters of the Light. Many would be at the passes tending shields, making sure none of the Imperial Order soldiers could get through. Zed had taught them to consider every possibility, no matter how outlandish, and guard against it. Day and night, Verna ran every one of those places through her mind, trying to think if there was anything they had overlooked, anything they had missed, that might allow the enemy forces to flood in upon them. If that happened, if they broke through, then there was nothing to stop their advance into Dahara, except the defending army, and the defending army was no match for the numbers on the other side of those mountains. She couldn't think of any chink in their armor, but she worried constantly that there might be one. It seemed that the final battle might be on them at any moment. And where was Richard? Prophecy said that he was vital in the battle to decide the future course of mankind, with it appearing that they very well could be one battle from the end of it all, a freedom's final spark. The Lord Rawl ran the very real risk of missing the moment of his greatest need. She could hardly believe that for centuries, prophecy foretold of the one who would lead them. And when the time finally arrives, he's off somewhere else. A lot of good prophecy was doing them. Verna knew Richard's heart. She knew Kalin's heart. It wasn't right to doubt either of them. But Verna was the one staring into the eyes of Jigang's horde, and Richard was nowhere to be found. From what little information Verna had gleaned from Anne's messages in the journey book, there was trouble afoot. Verna could detect in Anne's writings that the woman was greatly troubled by something. Whatever the cause, Anne and Nathan were racing south, back down through the old world. Anne avoided explaining, possibly not wanting to burden them with anything else, so Verna didn't press. She had enough trouble conceiving of why Anne would have joined with the prophet rather than collaring him. Anne said only that a journey book was not a good place to explain such things. Despite the good work the man sometimes did, Verna considered Nathan dangerous in the extreme. A thunderstorm brought life-giving rain, but if you were the one struck by its lightning, it didn't do you much good. For Anne and Nathan to join forces, as it were, must be indicative of the trouble they were all in. Verna had to remind herself that not everything was going against them, not everything was hopeless and dismal. Jigang's army had, after all, suffered a stunning blow at the hands of Zed and Addy, losing staggering numbers of soldiers in an instant and suffering vast numbers of casualties. As a result, the Imperial Order had turned away from Adendrill, leaving the Wizard's Keep untouched. Despite the Dreamwalker's covetous hands, the keep remained out of his reach. Zed and Addy had the defense of the keep well in hand, so it was not all trouble and strife. There were valuable assets on the side of the Daharan Empire. The keep might yet prove decisive in helping to stop the Imperial Order. Verna missed that old wizard, his advice, his wisdom, though she would never admit it aloud. In that old man, she could see where Richard got many of his best qualities. Verna halted when she saw Rika striding across in front of her. Verna snatched the Mord Sith's arm. "What is it, prelate?" Rika asked.
"Have you heard what this is about?"
Rika gave her a blank look.
What's about?"
The messenger stopped on the other side of the intersection of informal roads. Horses trotted past in both directions, one pulling a cart of water barrels. Fully armed men crossed on the side road. The encampment, one of several, surrounded by a defensive berm, had evolved up into a city of sorts, with byways through its midst for men, horses, and wagons.
"Something is going on," Verna said.
"Sorry, I haven't heard anything."
"Are you busy?"
"Nothing urgent."
Verna took a good grip on Rika's arm and started her walking.
"General Myford sent for me. Maybe you'd best come along. That way, if he wants you too, we won't have to send someone looking for you."
Rika shrugged.
"Fine by me."
The Mord Sith's expression turned suspicious.
"Do you have any idea what's wrong?"
As Verna kept an eye on the messenger ahead of her, weaving his way among men, tents, wagons, horses, and repair stations, she glanced over at Rika.
Nothing that I know of.
Verna's expression contorted a bit as she tried to put her queasy mood into words.
Did you ever wake up and just feel like there was something wrong, but you couldn't explain why it seemed like it was going to be a bad day?
If it's going to be a bad day, I see to it that it's someone else's, and I'm the cause of it. Verna smiled to herself.
Too bad you're not gifted. You would make a good sister of the light.
I would rather be Mord Sith and be able to protect Lord Rahl. The messenger stopped at the side of the camp road.
Back there, prelate. General Myford said to bring you to that tent by the trees.
Verna thanked the young man and made her way across the soft ground, Rika at her side. The tent was away from the main activity of the camp in a quieter area where officers often met with scouts just back from patrols. Verna's mind raced, trying to imagine what news scouts could have brought back. There was no alarm, so the passes still held. If there was trouble, there would be a flurry of activity in the camp, but it seemed about the same as any other day. Guards saw Verna coming and ducked into the tent to announce her arrival. Almost immediately, the general stepped out of the tent and rushed to meet her. His blue eyes reflected iron determination. The man's face, though, was ashen.
I saw Rika,
Verna explained as General Myford dipped his head in a hurried greeting.
I thought I ought to bring her just in case you needed her, too.
The tall, blonde-headed Daharan glanced briefly at Rika.
Yes, that's fine. Come in, please, both of you.
Verna snatched his sleeve.
What's this about? What's going on? Is something wrong?
The general's eyes moved to Rika and back to Verna.
We've had a message from Jagang.
Rika leaned in, her voice taking on an edge.
How did a messenger from Jagang get through without someone killing him?
It was standard practice that no one came through for any reason. They didn't want so much as a mouse making it through. There was no telling if it might be some kind of trick.
It was a small wagon pulled by a single horse.
He tilted his head toward Verna.
The men thought the wagon was empty. Remembering your instructions, they let it through.
Verna was somewhat surprised that Anne's warning to let an empty wagon through had been so correct.
A wagon came of its own accord? An empty wagon drove itself in?
Not exactly. The men who saw it thought it was empty. The horse appeared to be a workhorse that is used to walking roads, so it plodded along the road as it had been trained.
General Myford pressed his lips together at the confusion on Verna's face and then turned away from the tent.
Come on, and I'll show you.
He led them to the third tent down the line and held the flap aside. Verna ducked in, followed by Rika and the general. On the bench inside sat a young novice, Holly, with her arm around a very frightened-looking girl no more than 10 years old.
I asked Holly to stay with her, General Myford whispered. I thought it might make her less nervous than a soldier standing over her.
Of course, Verna said. Very wise of you. She's the one who brought the message, then?
The young general nodded.
She was sitting in the back of the wagon, so the men, seeing it coming, at first thought it was empty.
Verna now understood why such a messenger got through. Soldiers weren't nearly so likely to kill a child, and the sisters could test her to ensure she was no threat. Verna wondered if Zed would have something to say about that. Threat often came in surprising packages. Verna approached the pair on the bench, smiling as she bent down.
I'm Verna. Are you all right, young lady?
The girl nodded.
Would you like something to eat?
Trembling slightly as her big brown eyes took in the people looking at her, she nodded again.
Prelate,
Holly said.
Valerie already went to get her something.
I see,
Verna said, holding the smile in place. She knelt down and gently patted the girl's hands in her lap to reassure her.
Do you live around here?
The girl's big brown eyes blinked, trying to judge the danger of the adult before her. She calmed just a little at Verna's smile and kind touch.
A bit of travel to the north, ma'am.
And someone sent you to see us?
The big brown eyes filled with tears, but she didn't cry.
My parents are back there, down over the pass. The soldiers there have them. As guests, they said. Men came and took us to their army. We've had to stay there for the last few weeks. Today they told me to take a letter over the pass to the people here. They said that if I did as I was told, they would let my mother and father and me go home.
Verna again patted the girl's small hands.
I see. Well, that's good of you to help your parents. I just want to go home.
And you shall, child. Verna straightened. We'll get you some food, dear, so you have a full tummy before you go back to your parents. The girl stood and curtsied.
Thank you for your kindness. May I go back after I eat, then?
Certainly, Verna said. I'll just go read the letter you brought while you have a nice meal, and then you can return to your parents. As she sat back up on the bench, squirming her bottom back beside Holly, she couldn't help keeping a wary eye on the moored Sith. Trying not to show any apprehension, Verna smiled her goodbye to the girl before leading the others out of the tent. She couldn't even imagine what Jagang was up to.
What's in the letter?
Verna asked, as they hurried to the command tent. General Myford paused outside the tent, his thumb burnishing a brass button on his coat as he met Verna's gaze.
I'd just as soon you read it for yourself, prelate. Some of it's plain enough. Some of it, well, some of it I'm hoping you can explain to me.
Stepping into the tent, Verna saw Captain Zimmer waiting off to the side. The square-jawed man was absent his usual infectious smile. The captain was in charge of the Daharan Special Forces, a group of men whose job it was to go out and spend their days and nights sneaking around in enemy territory, killing as many of the enemy as possible. There seemed to be an endless supply. The captain seemed determined to use up the supply. The men in Captain Zimmer's corps were very good at what they did. They collected strings of ears they took from the enemies they killed. Kalin used to always ask to see their collection whenever they returned. The captain and his men dearly missed her. They all glanced up at a flash of lightning. The storm was getting closer. After a moment's pause, the ground shook with the rolling rumble of thunder. General Myford retrieved a small folded paper from the table and handed it to Verna. This is what the girl brought. Looking briefly to the two men's grim expressions, Verna unfolded the paper and read the neat script. I have Wizard Zorander and a sorceress named Addie. I now hold the wizard's keep in Aidendrill and all it contains. My slide will soon present me with Lord Rawl and the Mother Confessor. Your cause is lost. If you surrender now and open the passes, I will spare your men. If you do not, I will put every one of them to death. Signed, Jagang the Just. The arm holding the paper in her trembling fingers lowered.
Dear Creator, Verna whispered.
She felt dizzy. Rika snatched the paper from her hand and stood facing away as she read it. She cursed under her breath.
We have to go get him, Rika said. We have to get Zed and Addie away from Jagang.
Captain Zimmer shook his head.
There is no way we could accomplish such a thing.
Rika's face went red with rage.
He saved my life before, yours too. We have to get him out of there.
In contrast to Rika's anger, Verna spoke softly.
We all feel the same about him. Zed has probably saved all of our lives more than once. Unfortunately, Jagang will do all the worse to him for it.
Rika shook the message before their faces. So, we are just going to let him die there, let Jagang kill him, we sneak in or something. Captain Zimmer rested the heel of his hand on a long knife at his belt.
Mistress Rika, if I told you that I had a man hidden somewhere in this camp, in one of the hundreds of thousands of tents, and no one would bother you or ask you any questions, but would allow you to freely go about a search, how long do you think it would take you to find such a hidden man?
But they won't be in just any tent, Rika said. Look at us here. This message came. Did it go to just any random tent in the whole camp? No, it went to a place where such things are handled.
I've been to the Imperial Order encampment too many times to count, Captain Zimmer said as he cast his arm out toward the enemy over the mountains to the west. You can't even imagine how big their camp is.
They have millions of men there. Their encampment is a quagmire of cutthroats. It's a place of chaos. That disorder allows us to slip in, kill some of them, and get out fast. You don't want to be there very long. They recognize outsiders, especially blonde outsiders. Moreover, there are layers of different kinds of men. Most of the soldiers are little more than a mob of thugs that Jigang turns loose from time to time. None of them are allowed beyond a certain point within their own camp. The men guarding the areas with higher security are not nearly so stupid and lazy as the common soldiers. The men in those protected areas aren't as numerous as the common soldiers, but they are trained professionals. They are alert, vigilant, and deadly. If you could somehow manage to get through the sea of misfits to reach the island at the core where the torture and command tents are, those professional soldiers would have you on the end of a pike in no time. Even they are not all the same. The outer ring of this core, besides having these professionals guarding it, is where the sisters are. They both live there and use magic to watch for intruders. Beyond them are further rings, starting with the elite guards, and then, finally, the Emperor's personal guards. These are men who have been fighting with Jigang for years. They kill anyone, even the elite guard officers, if they become at all suspicious of them. If they even hear word of someone saying disparaging things about the Emperor, they hunt them down and have them tortured. After being tortured, if they live through it, they are then put to death. I'm not saying that my men and I would be unwilling to risk our lives trying to get Zed out of there. I'm saying that we would be giving our lives up for nothing. The mood in the tent could not have been more hopeless. The general gestured with the paper when Rika handed it back. Any idea what a slide is, prelate? Verna met his blue-eyed gaze. A soul stealer. The general frowned. A what? In the Great War, 3,000 years ago, the wizards of that time created weapons out of people. Dreamwalkers like Jigang were one such weapon. The best way I can explain it to you is that a slide is in some ways like a dreamwalker. A dreamwalker can enter a person's mind and seize control of them. A slide, I believe, is something like that, only he seizes your spirit, your soul. Rika made a face. Why? Verna lifted her hands in frustration. I don't really know. To control their victim, perhaps. Altering gifted people was an ancient practice. They sometimes changed gifted people with magic to suit a specific purpose. With subtractive magic, they took away traits they didn't want, and then they used additive magic to add to or enhance a trait they did want. What they created were monsters. I'm not really well versed in the subject. When I became prelate, I had access to books I had never seen before. That's where I saw the reference to slides. They were used to slip into another person's being and seal the essence of who they were, their spirit, their soul. Altering people in such a way as to create these slides is a long-dead art. I'm afraid that I don't know a great deal about the subject. I do remember reading that the ones called slides were exceedingly dangerous.
Long-dead art, the general muttered. He looked like he was making a great effort to restrain himself. Those wizards of that time made such weapons as slides. But how could Jigang? He's no wizard. Could it be that he's lying?
Verna thought about the question a moment. He has gifted people under his direct control. Some are able to use underworld magic. As I said, I don't know a great deal about it, but I suppose it's possible that he was able to do it.
How? The general demanded. How could Jigang do such things? He's not even a wizard.
Verna clasped her hands before herself. He has sisters of the light and the dark. In theory, I suppose he has what he needs. He is a man who studies history. I know from personal experience that he puts great value in books. He has an extensive and quite valuable collection. Nathan the prophet was very concerned about this very thing and destroyed a number of important volumes before they could fall into Jigang's possession. Still, the Emperor possesses a great many others. In fact, he has a huge collection. Now that he has captured the keep, he has access to important libraries. Those books are dangerous, or they wouldn't have been sealed away in the wizard's keep in the first place.
And now Jigang has control of them. General Myford ran his fingers back through his hair.
He gripped the back of the chair set before the small table and leaned his weight on his arms.
Do you think he really has Zed and Addy?
The question was a plea for some thread of hope. Verna swallowed as she carefully considered the question. She answered in an honest voice, not wanting to be the founder of a false faith. Since she'd read the message from Jagang, she herself had been searching for that same thread of hope.
"I don't think he's a man who would find any satisfaction in bragging about something he hadn't actually accomplished. I think he must be telling us the truth and wants to gloat over his accomplishment."
The general released his grip on the chair and turned as he considered Verna's words. Finally, he asked a question, worse yet.
"Do you think he's telling the truth, that this slide has Lord Rawl and the Mother Confessor? Do you think this terrible creation, this slide, will soon deliver the two of them to Jagang?"
Verna wondered if this was the reason for Anne and Nathan's headlong rush down through the old world. Verna knew that Richard and Kaelin were down there somewhere. There could be no more urgent reason for Anne and Nathan to race south. Was it possible that this slide had already captured them, or captured their souls? Verna's heart sank. She wondered if Anne already knew that the slide had Richard, and that was why she wasn't saying much about her mission.
"I don't know,"
Verna finally answered.
"I think Jagang just made a mistake," Captain Zimmer said.
Verna lifted an eyebrow.
"Such as?"
"He has just betrayed to us how much trouble he's having with the passes. He's just told us how well our defenses are working and how desperate he is. If he doesn't get through this season, his whole army will have to sit out another winter. He wants us to let him through. Daharan winters are hard, especially on men such as his, men not used to the conditions. I saw with my own eyes good indications of how many men he lost last winter. Hundreds of thousands of men died from disease."
"He has plenty of men," General Myford said. "He can afford the losses. He has a steady supply of new troops to replace the ones who died from the fevers and sickness last winter."
"So you think the captain is wrong?"
Verna asked.
"No. I agree that Jagang would like very much to get it over with. I just don't think he cares how many of his men die. I think he's eager to rule the world. Patient as he generally is, he sees the end at hand, the goal within his grasp. We're the only thing standing in his way, keeping his prize from falling to him. His men, too, are impatient for the plunder. His choice to split the new world first by driving up to Adendrill has left him close to his goal, but in some ways even more distant from it. If he can't make it through the passes, he may decide to pick up his army and make a long march back south again to the Kern River Valley, to where he can then come over and up into Dahara. Once his army takes to the open ground down south, there's no way for us to stop them. If he can't break through the passes now, it means a long march and a long delay. But he will still have us in the end. He would rather have us now and is willing to offer the lives of our men to close a deal."
Verna stared off.
"It's a grave mistake to try to appease evil."
"I agree," General Myford said. "Once we opened the passes, he would slaughter every last man."
The mood in the tent was as gloomy as the sky outside.
"I think we should send him back a letter," Rika said. "I think we should tell him that we don't believe him, that he has Zed and Addy. If he expects us to believe him, he should prove it. He should send us their heads."
Captain Zimmer smiled at the suggestion. The general tapped a finger on the table as he thought it over.
"If it's as you say, prelate, and Jagang really does have them, then there's nothing we can do about it. He will kill them. After what Zed did to Jagang's force back in Adendrill, to say nothing of all the havoc he caused the Imperial Order last summer when the Mother Confessor was with us, I know it won't be an easy death. But he will kill them in the end."
"Then you agree that nothing else can be done?" Verna said.
General Myford wiped a hand across his face.
"I hate admitting it, but I'm afraid they're lost. I don't think we should give Jagang the satisfaction of knowing how we truly feel about it."
Verna's head spun at the thought of Zed and Addy being put to torture, of them being in the hands of Jagang and his sisters of the dark. She quailed at the thought of the Daharan forces losing Zed. There simply was no one with his experience and knowledge. There was no one who could replace him.
We write Jigang a letter then, Verna said, and tell Jigang we don't believe he has Zed and Addy.
The only thing we can do, Rika said, is to deny Jigang what he wants most. What he wants is for us to give up.
General Myford pulled out the chair at the table, inviting Verna to sit and write the letter.
If Jigang is angered by such a letter, he just might send us their heads. If he did, that would spare them terrible suffering. That's the only thing we can do for them, the best we could do for them.
Verna took stock of the grim faces and saw only resolve at what had to be done. She sat in the chair the general held for her, wiggled the stopper out of the ink bottle, and then took a piece of paper from a small stack in a box to the side. She dipped the pen and stared at the paper for a moment, trying to decide how to phrase the letter. She tried to imagine what Kalin would write. As it came to her, she bent over the table and began writing.
I don't believe you are competent enough to capture Wizard Zorander. If you were, you would send us his head to prove it. Don't bother me anymore with your whining for us to open the passes for you because you are too inept to do it for yourself.
Reading over Verna's shoulder, Rika said, I like it.
Verna looked up at the others. How should I sign it?
What would make Jigang the most angry or worried? Captain Zimmer asked.
Verna tapped the back of the pen against her chin as she thought. Then it came to her. She put pen to paper. Signed, The Mother Confessor. Chapter 47. Richard scanned the site off in the broad green valley, watching for any signs of troops. He looked over at Owen.
That's Witherton?
Hands pressed against the rich forest floor at the crown of a low ridge, Owen pulled himself closer to the edge. He stretched his neck to see over the rise and finally nodded before pulling back.
Richard had thought it would be bigger.
I don't see any soldiers.
Owen crawled back away from the edge. In the shadowed cover, among ferns and low scrub, he stood and brushed the moist crumbles of leaves from his shirt and trousers.
The men of the Order mostly stay inside the town. They have no interest in helping to do the work. They eat our food and gamble with the things they have taken from our people. When they do these things, they are interested in little else.
His face heated to red.
At night, they used to collect some of our women.
Since the reason was obvious enough, Owen didn't put words to it.
In the daytime, they sometimes come out to check on our people who work in the fields, or watch to see that they come back in at night.
If the soldiers had once camped outside the city walls, they no longer did. Apparently, they preferred the more comfortable accommodations the town had to offer. They had learned that these people would offer no resistance. They could be cowed and controlled by words alone. The men of the Imperial Order were safe, sleeping among them. The wall around Witherton blocked much of Richard's view of the place. Other than through the open gates, there wasn't much to see. The wall was constructed of upright posts, not a great deal taller than the height of a man. The posts, a variety of sizes no bigger around than a hand width, were bound tightly together, top and bottom, with rope. The wavy wall snaked around the town, leaned in or out in places. There was no bulwark, or even a trench before the wall. Other than keeping out grazing deer or maybe a roaming bear, the wall certainly didn't look strong enough to withstand an attack from the Imperial Order soldiers. The soldiers had no doubt made a point of using the gate into the town for reasons other than the strength of the wall. Opening the gates for soldiers of the Imperial Order had been a symbolic sign of submission. Broad swaths of the valley were clear of trees, leaving fields of grain to grow alongside row crops in communal gardens. Tree limbs knitted into fencing kept in cows. There, the wild grasses were chewed low. Chickens roamed freely near coops. A few sheep dotted the sweep of grass. The smells of rich soil, wildflowers and grasses carried on a light breeze into the woods where Richard watched. It was a great relief to have finally descended from the pass. It had been getting difficult to breathe in the thin air up on the high slopes. It was considerably warmer, too, down out of the lofty mountain pass, although he still felt cold. Richard checked the sweep of open valley one last time, and then he and Owen made their way back into the dense tangle of woods
toward where the others waited. The trees were mostly hardwoods, maple and oak, along with patches of birch, but there were also stands of towering evergreens. Birds chirped from the dense foliage. A squirrel up on the limb of a pine chattered at them as they passed. The deep shade below the thick forest crown was interrupted only occasionally by mottled sunlight. Some of the men, swatting at bugs, stood in a rush when Richard led Owen into the secluded forest opening. Richard was glad to stand in the warmth of sunlight slanting in at a low angle. It appeared that the open area in the dense woods had been created when a huge old maple had been hit by lightning. The maple split and fell in two directions, taking other trees down with it. Kaylin hopped down off her seat on the trunk of the fallen monarch. Betty, her tail wagging in a blur, greeted Richard, eagerly looking for attention or a treat. Richard scratched behind her ears, the goat's favorite form of attention. More of the men came into the open from behind upturned roots that had been turned silver by years of exposure to the elements. A crop of spruce, none more than chest high, had sprung up in the sunny spot created when the old maple had died such a sudden and violent death. Spread among Kaylin, Kara, Jensen, and Tom were the rest of the men, his army. Back up in the pass, Anson saying that he wanted to help rid his people of the Imperial Order soldiers seemed to have galvanized the rest of the men, and the balance had finally tipped. Once it had, a lifetime of darkness and doubt gave way to a hunger to live in the light of truth. The men all declared, in a breathtaking moment of determination, that they wanted to join with Richard to be part of the Dharan Empire and fight the soldiers of the Imperial Order and to gain their freedom. They had all decided that the men of the Order were evil and deserved death, even if they themselves had to do the killing. When Tom glanced down to see Betty going back to browsing on weeds, Richard noticed that the man's brow was dotted with sweat. Kara fanned herself with a handful of big leaves from a mountain maple. Richard was about to ask them how they could be sweating when it was such a cool day, when he realized that it was the poison making him cold. With icy dread, he recalled how the last time he had gotten cold, the poison had nearly killed him that awful night. Anson and another man, John, took off their packs. They were the ones planning to slip in among the field workers returning to town at nightfall. Once they sneaked into town, the two men planned to recover the antidote. "I think I'd better go with you," Richard said to Anson. "John, why don't you wait here with the others?" John looked surprised. "If you wish, Lord Rawl, but there is no need for you to go." It wasn't supposed to be a foray that would result in any violence, only the recovery of the antidote. The attack on the Imperial Order soldiers was to be after the antidote had been safely recovered, and they had assessed the situation, the number of men, and the layout. "John is right," Kara said. "They can do it." Richard was having difficulty breathing. He had to make an effort not to cough. "I know. I just think I had better have a look myself." Kara and Kaylin cast a sidelong glance at each other. "But if you go in there with Anson," Jensen said, "you can't take your sword." "I'm not going to start a war. I just want to get a good look around at the place." Kaylin stepped closer. "The two of them can scout the town and give you a report. You can rest. They will only be gone a few hours." "I know, but I don't think I want to wait that long." By the way she appraised his eyes, he thought she must be able to see how much pain he was in. She didn't argue the point further, but instead nodded her agreement. Richard pulled the baldric and sword belt off over his head. He slipped it all over Kaylin's head, laying the baldric across her shoulder. "Here, I pronounce you the seeker of truth." She accepted the sword and the honor by planting her fists on her hips. "Now don't you go starting anything while you're in there. That's not the plan. You and Anson will be alone. You wait until we're all together." "I know. I just need to get the antidote, and then we'll be back in no time." Beside getting the antidote, Richard wanted to see the enemy forces, how they were placed, and the layout of the town. Having the men draw a map in the dirt was one thing. Seeing it for himself was another. These men didn't know how to evaluate threat points. One of the men took off his light coat, something a number of the men wore, and held it out to Richard.
Here, Lord Rawl, wear this. It will make you look more like one of us.
With a nod of thanks, Richard drew the coat on. He had changed out of his war wizard's outfit into traveling clothes, so he didn't think he would look out of place with the way the men from the town of Witherton looked. The man was nearly Richard's size, so the coat fit well enough. It also hid his belt knife.
Jensen shook her head.
I don't know, Richard. You just don't look like one of them. You still look like Lord Rawl.
What are you talking about?
Richard held out his arms, looking down at himself. What's wrong with the way I looked?
Don't stand up so straight, she said.
Hunch your shoulders and hang your head a little, Kaelin offered. Richard took their advice seriously. He hadn't thought about it, but the men did tend to hunch a lot. He didn't want to stand out. He had to blend in if he didn't want to raise the suspicions of the soldiers. He bent over a little.
How's that?
Jensen screwed up her mouth.
Not much different, but I'm bending down.
Lord Rawl, Kara said in a soft voice as she gave him a meaningful look, you remember how it was to walk behind Denna when she held the chain to the collar around your neck? Make yourself like that.
Richard blinked at her.
The mental image of his time as a captive of a moored Sith hit him like a slap. He pressed his lips tight, not saying anything, and conceded with a single nod. The memory of that forsaken time was depressing enough that he would have no trouble using it to fall into the role.
We had better be on our way, Anson said. Now that the sun is falling behind the mountains, darkness comes quickly.
He hesitated, then spoke again.
Lord Rawl, the men of the Order will not know you. I mean, they probably will not realize you aren't from our town. But our people do not carry weapons. If they see that knife, they will know you are not from our town, and they will send up an alarm.
Richard lifted open the coat, looking at the knife.
You're right.
He loosened his belt and removed the sheath holding the knife. He handed it to Kara for safekeeping.
Richard cupped a hand quickly to the side of Kaelin's face as a way of saying his goodbye.
She seized the hand in both of hers and pressed a quick kiss to the backs of his fingers. Her hands looked so small and delicate holding his. He sometimes kidded her that he didn't see how she could possibly get anything done with such small hands. Her answer was that her hands were a normal size and perfectly adequate, and his were simply outsized. The men all noticed Kaelin's gesture of affection. Richard was not embarrassed that they did. He wanted them to know that other people were the same as they in important human ways. This was what they were fighting for, the chance to be human, to love and cherish loved ones, to live their life as they wanted. The light faded quickly as Richard and Anson made their way through the woods running beside fields of wild grasses. Richard wanted to work around to where the forest came in closer to the men, out weeding in the gardens and tending to animals. With the nearby mountains to the west being so high, the sun vanished behind them earlier than what would normally be sunset, leaving the sky a swath of deep bluish green and the valley in an odd golden gloom. By the time he and Anson had reached the place where they would leave the woods, it was still a little too light, so they waited a short while until Richard felt the murky light in the fields was dim enough to hide them. The town was some distance away, and since Richard couldn't make out any men outside the gates, he reasoned that if soldiers were watching, then they couldn't see him either. As they moved quickly through the field of wild grass, staying low and out of sight, Anson pointed.
There! Those men going back to town. We should follow them.
Richard spoke quietly back over his shoulder. All right, but don't forget, we don't want to catch up with them or they might recognize you and make a fuss. Let them stay a good distance ahead of us.
When they reached the town walls, Richard saw that the gates were no more than two sections of the picket walls. A couple of posts, no bigger than Richard's wrist, had been tied sideways to stiffen two sections of wall and make them into gates. The ropes that tied the posts together served as the hinges. The sections were simply lifted and swung around to open or close them. It was far from a secure fortification. In the murky light of twilight, the two guards milling around just inside the gates and watching workers return couldn't really see much of Richard and Anson. To the guards, they would appear to be two more workers. The Order understood the value of workers.
They needed slaves to do the work, so that the soldiers might eat. Richard hunched his shoulders and hung his head as he walked. He remembered those terrible times as a captive when, wearing a collar, he walked behind Denna, devoid of all hope of ever again being free. Thinking of that inhuman time, he shuffled through the open gates. The guards didn't pay him any attention. Just as they were nearly past the guards, the closest one reached out and snatched Anson's sleeve, spinning him back around.
"I want some eggs," the young soldier said. "Give me some of the eggs you collected."
Anson stood wide-eyed, not knowing what to do. It seemed ludicrous that these two young men were allowed to serve their cause by being bullies. Richard stepped up beside Anson and spoke quickly, remembering to bow his head so that he wouldn't loom over the man.
"We have no eggs, sir. We were weeding the bean fields. I'm sorry, we will bring you eggs tomorrow if it pleases you."
Richard glanced up just as the guard backhanded him, knocking him flat on his back. He instantly took a firm grip on his anger. Wiping blood from his mouth, he decided to stay where he was.
"He's right," Anson said, drawing the guard's attention. "We were weeding beans. If you wish it, we will bring you some eggs tomorrow, as many as you want."
The guard grunted a curse at them and swaggered off, taking his companion with him. They headed for a nearby long, low structure with a torch lashed to a pole outside a low door. In the flickering light of that torch, Richard couldn't make out what the place was, but it appeared to be a building dug partway into the ground so that the eaves were at eye level. After the two soldiers were a safe distance away, Anson offered Richard a hand to help him up. Richard didn't think he'd been hit that hard, but his head was spinning. As they started out, faces back in doorways and around dark corners peeked out to watch them. When Richard looked their way, the people ducked back in.
"They know you are not from here," Anson whispered.
Richard didn't trust that one of those people wouldn't call the guards.
"Let's hurry up and get what we came here for."
Anson nodded and hurriedly led Richard down a narrow street with what looked like little more than huts huddled together to each side. The single torch burning outside the long building where the soldiers had gone provided little light down the street. The town, at least what Richard could see of it in the dark, was a pretty shabby-looking place. In fact, he wouldn't call it a town so much as a village. Many of the structures appeared to be housing for livestock, not people. Only rarely were there any lights coming from any of the squat buildings, and the light he did see looked like it came from candles, not lamps. At the end of the street, Richard followed Anson through a small side door into a larger building. The cows inside mooed at the intrusion. Sheep rustled in their pens. A few goats in other pens bleated. Richard and Anson paused to let the animals settle down before making their way through the barn to a ladder at the side. Richard followed Anson as he climbed quickly to a small hayloft. At the end of the loft, Anson reached up over a low rafter to where it tied into the wall behind a crossbrace.
"Here it is," he said as he grimaced, stretching his arm up into the hiding place.
He came out with a small, square-sided bottle and handed it to Richard.
"This is the antidote. Hurry and drink it, and then let's get out of here."
The large door banged open. Even though it was dark outside, the torch down the street provided just enough light to silhouette the broad shape of a man standing in the doorway. By his demeanor, he had to be a soldier. Richard pulled the stopper from the bottle. The antidote had the slight aroma of cinnamon. He quickly downed it, hardly noticing its sweet, spicy taste. He never took his eyes off the man in the doorway.
"Who's in here?"
the man bellowed.
"Sir," Richard called out, "I'm just getting some hay for the livestock."
"In the dark? What are you up to? Get down here right now."
Richard put a hand against Anson's chest and pushed him back into the darkness.
"Yes, sir, I'm coming,"
Richard called to the soldier as he hurried down the ladder. At the bottom of the ladder, he turned and saw the man coming toward him. Richard reached for his knife under the coat he was wearing, only remembering then that he didn't have his knife. The soldier was still silhouetted against the open barn door. Richard was in the darkness, and the man probably wouldn't be able to see him. He silently moved away from the ladder.
As the soldier passed near him, Richard stepped in behind him and reached to his side, seizing the knife sheathed behind the axe hanging on his belt. Richard gingerly drew the knife just as the man stopped and looked up the ladder to the hayloft. As he was looking up, Richard seized a fistful of hair with one hand and reached around with the other, slicing deep through the soldier's throat before he realized what was happening. Richard held the man tight as he struggled, a wet gurgling the only sound coming from him. He reached back, frantically snatching at Richard for a moment before his movements lost their energy, and he went limp.
"Anson!"
Richard whispered up the ladder as he let the man slip to the ground.
"Come on, let's go!"
Anson hurried down the ladder, coming to a halt as he reached the bottom and turned around to see the dark shape of the dead man sprawled on the ground.
"What happened?"
Richard looked up from his work at undoing the weapons belt around the dead weight of the soldier. "I killed him."
"Oh."
Richard handed the knife in its sheath to Anson. "Here you go. Now you have a real weapon, a long knife." Richard rolled the dead soldier over to pull the belt the rest of the way out from under the man. As he tugged it free, he heard a noise and turned just in time to see another soldier running in toward them. Anson slammed the long knife hilt deep into the man's chest. The man staggered back. Richard shot to his feet, bringing the weapons belt with him. The soldier gasped for breath as he clutched at the knife handle. He dropped heavily to his knees. One hand clawed at the air above him as he swayed. Pulling a final gasp, he toppled to his side. Anson stood staring at the man, lying in a heap, the knife jutting from his chest. He bent then and pulled his new knife free.
"Are you all right?"
Richard whispered when Anson stood. Anson nodded.
"I recognize this man. We called him the Weasel. He deserved to die."
Richard gently clapped Anson on the back of the shoulder. "You did well. Now let's get out of here." As they made their way back up the street, Richard asked Anson to wait while he checked down alleyways and between low buildings, searching for soldiers. As a guide, Richard often scouted at night. In the darkness, he was in his element. The town was a lot smaller than he had expected. It was also much less organized than he thought it would be, with no apparent order to where the simple structures had been built. The streets through the haphazard town, if they could be called streets, were in most cases little more than footpaths between clusters of small single-room buildings. He saw a few handcarts, but nothing more elaborate. There was only one road through the town, leading back to the barn where they had recovered the antidote, and run into the two soldiers that was wide enough to accommodate a wagon. His search didn't turn up any patrolling soldiers.
"Do you know if all the men of the order stay together?" Richard asked when he returned to Anson, waiting in the shadows.
"At night they go inside. They sleep in our place, by where we came in."
"You mean that low building where the first two soldiers went?"
"That's right. That's where most people used to gather at night, but now the men of the order use it for themselves."
Richard frowned at the man. "You mean you all slept together?" Anson sounded mildly surprised by the question.
"Yes. We were together whenever possible. Many people had a house where they could work, eat, and keep belongings, but they rarely slept in it. We usually all slept in the sleeping houses where we gathered to talk about the day. Everyone wanted to be together. Sometimes people would sleep in another place, but mostly we sleep there together so we can all feel safe. Much like we all slept together at night as we made our way down out of the pass with the statue."
"And everyone just lay down together?"
Anson diverted his eyes.
"Couples often slept apart from others by being with one another under a single blanket, but they were still together with our people. In the dark, though, no one could see them together under a blanket."
Richard had trouble imagining such a way of life. "The whole town fit in that sleeping building? There was enough room?"
"No, there were too many of us to all sleep in one sleeping house. There are two," Anson pointed. "There is another on the far side of the one you saw."
"Let's go have a look then."
They moved quickly back toward the town gates, such as they were, and toward the sleeping houses. The dark street was empty. Richard didn't see anyone on the paths between buildings. What people were left in the town had apparently gone to sleep or were afraid to come out in the darkness. A door in one of the small homes opened a crack, as if someone inside were peering out. The door opened wider, and a thin figure dashed out toward them.
"Anson!"
came the whispered voice. It was a boy, in his early teens. He fell to his knees and clutched Anson's arm, kissing his hand in joy to see him.
"Anson, I am so happy that you are home. We've missed you so much we feared for you, feared that you were murdered."
Anson grabbed the boy by his shirt and hauled him to his feet.
"Bernie, I'm well and I'm happy to see you well, but you must go back in now. The men will see you. If they catch you outside..." "Oh, please, Anson, come sleep at our house. We're so alone and afraid."
"Who?"
"Just me and my grandfather now. Please come in and be with us."
"I can't right now. Maybe another time." The boy peered up at Richard then, and when he saw that he didn't recognize him, shrank back.
"This is a friend of mine, Bernie, from another town."
Anson squatted down beside the boy.
"Please, Bernie, I will return, but you must go back inside and stay there tonight. Don't come out. We fear there might be trouble. Stay inside. Tell your grandfather my words, will you now?"
Bernie finally agreed and ran back into the dark doorway. Richard was eager to get out of the town before anyone else came out to pay their respects. If he and Anson weren't careful, they would end up attracting the attention of the soldiers. They moved quickly the rest of the way up the street, using buildings for cover. Pressing up against the side of one at the head of the street, Richard peered around the corner at the squat, daub and wattle sleeping house where the guards had gone. The door was open, letting soft light spill out across the ground.
"In there?"
Richard whispered.
"You all slept in there?"
"Yes. That is one of the sleeping houses, and beyond it, the other one." Richard thought about it for a moment.
"What did you sleep on?"
"Hay. We put blankets over it usually. We change the hay often to keep it fresh, but these men do not bother. They sleep like animals in dusty old hay."
Richard looked out through the open gates at the fields. He looked back at the sleeping house.
"And now the soldiers all sleep in there?"
"Yes, they took the place from us. They said it was to be their barracks. Now our people, the ones still alive, must sleep wherever they can."
Richard made Anson stay put while he slipped through the shadows, out of the light of the torch, to survey the area beyond the first building. The second long structure also had soldiers inside, laughing and talking. There were more men than were needed to guard such a small place, but Witherton was the gateway into Bandikar, and the gateway out.
"Come on," Richard said, as he came up beside Anson. "Let's get back to the others. I have an idea."
As they made their way to the gate, Richard looked up, as he often did, to check the starry sky for any sign of black-tipped races. He saw instead that the pole to each side of the gate held a body hanging by the ankles. When Anson saw them, he paused, held frozen by the horror of the sight. Richard laid a hand on the man's shoulder and leaned closer.
"Are you all right?"
Anson shook his head.
"No. But I will be better when the men who come to us and do such things are dead."
Chapter 48. Richard didn't know if the antidote was supposed to make him feel better, but if it was, it hadn't yet done its work. As they crept through the pitch-black fields, his chest hurt with every breath he took. He paused and closed his eyes briefly against the pain of the headache caused by his gift. He wanted nothing more than to lie down, but there was no time for that. Everyone started out once more when he did, quietly making their way through the fields outside Witherton. It felt good, at least, to have his sword back, even if he dreaded the thought of having to draw it for fear of finding its magic was no longer there for him. Once they recovered the other two bottles of the antidote and he was rid of the poison, then maybe they could make it back to Nikki so that she could help him deal with his gift. He tried not to worry if a sorceress could help a wizard once his gift had gone out of control, as his had. Nikki had vast experience. As soon as he reached her, she could help him. Even if she couldn't help him, he felt confident that she would at least know what he had to do in order to get the help he needed. After all, she was once a Sister of the Light. The purpose of the Sisters of the Light had been to help those with the gift to learn to control it.
"I think I see the outer wall," Kaelin said in a quiet voice.
"Yes, that's the place," Richard pointed.
There's the gate, see it?
I think so, she whispered back.
It was a dark night with no moon. While the others were having difficulty seeing much of anything as they made their way through the dark, Richard was glad for the conditions. The starlight was enough for him to see by, but he didn't think it was enough to give the soldiers any help in seeing them. As they crept closer, the sleeping house came into view through the open gate. The torch still burned outside the door to the building where the soldiers slept. Richard signaled everyone to gather around close. They all crouched low. He grabbed the shoulder of Anson's shirt and pulled him up closer yet, then did the same with Owen. Both now carried battle axes. Anson also carried the knife he'd earned. The rest of the men carried the weapons they had helped finish making. When Richard and Anson had returned to the forest clearing, Anson had told the waiting men everything that had happened. When he said that he had killed the man called the Weasel, Richard held his breath, not sure exactly how the men would react to hearing that one of their own had actually killed a man. There was a brief moment of astonished silence, and then spontaneous joy at the accomplishment. Every man wanted to shake Anson's hand to congratulate him, to tell him how proud they were. At that moment, any lingering doubts Richard harbored had vanished. He had allowed the men to celebrate briefly while he waited for the night to darken, and then they had started making their way through the fields. This was the night that Witherton gained its freedom. Richard looked around at all the dark shapes. All right now, remember all the things we've told you. You must stay quiet and hold the gate steady while Anson and Owen cut the rope where they hinge. Be careful not to let the gates fall once the ropes are cut. In the dim starlight, Richard could just make out the men nodding to his instructions. Richard carefully checked the sky, looking for any sign of black-tipped races. He didn't see any. It had been a long time since they'd seen any races. It seemed that the trick of taking to the forests just before they changed their expected route and being careful to stay out of sight from the sky had worked. It was possible that they had succeeded in slipping out from under Nicholas the Slide's surveillance. If they really had escaped his observation, then he wouldn't know where to begin looking for them. Richard briefly squeezed Kalin's hand and then started for the opening in the town wall. Kara crouched close at his other side. Tom was bringing up the rear, along with Jensen, making sure there were no surprises from behind. They had left Betty not only tied up, but confined to a makeshift pen to be sure she didn't follow after them and give them away at the wrong moment. The goat had been unusually distraught to be left behind, but with lives at stake they couldn't risk Jensen's goat causing trouble. She would be happy enough after they returned. When they reached the fields close to the town gates, Richard motioned for everyone to get down and stay where they were. Along with Tom, Richard moved up to the gates, taking cover in the shadow of the wall. There was a soldier just inside the gate, pacing slowly in his lonely nighttime sentry duty. He wasn't being very careful, or he would not be doing such duty in the light of the torch. As the soldier turned to walk away from them, Tom slipped up behind the man and swiftly silenced him. As Tom dragged the dead man through the gates to hide him in the darkness outside the wall, Richard moved in through the gates, staying in the shadows and away from the torch burning outside the sleeping house. The door to the sleeping house stood open, but no light or sound came from inside. This late, the men were bound to be asleep. He moved past the first long building to the second, and there came upon another guard. Quickly, silently, Richard seized the man and cut his throat, holding him tight as he struggled. When he finally went limp, Richard laid him in the darkness at the head of the second sleeping house, around the corner from the torchlight. In the distance, the men had already swarmed over the gates, holding them up while Anson and Owen worked quickly at cutting the ropes that acted as hinges. In moments, both sections of gate were freed. Richard could hear the soft grunts of effort as the heavy gates were manhandled around by the two gangs of men. Jensen handed Richard his bow, the string already strung. She handed him one of the special arrows, holding the rest at the ready for him. Kalin slipped up to the torch on the pole outside the first building, lit several small torches, handing each of them off to the men. She kept one for herself. Richard knocked the arrow, and then glanced around at the faces seeming to float before him in the wavering torchlight. In answer to the unspoken question, they all nodded that they were ready. He checked the men balancing the two gates and saw their nod. The bow in one hand, with his fist holding the arrow in place, Richard gave hand signals to the men, starting them moving. What had been a slow, careful approach from the woods into the town suddenly transformed into a headlong rush. Richard held the end of the arrow knocked in his bow in the flame of the torch Kalin held out for him. As soon as it caught, he ran to the open door of the sleeping house, leaned into the darkness, and fired the arrow toward the back. As the blazing arrow flew the length of the building, it illuminated row upon row of men sleeping on the bed of straw. The arrow landed at the far end, spilling flame across the straw. A few heads lifted at the confusing sight. Jensen handed Richard another. He immediately drew string to cheek, and the arrow shot toward the middle of the interior. As Richard pulled back from the doorway, two men with torches dripping flaming drops of pitch heaved them just inside. They hissed as they flew through the air, landing amid the sleeping men, bouncing and tumbling through the straw, igniting a wall of flame. In a matter of only a few heartbeats since the attack started, the first sleeping house was set afire from one end to the other. The largest blaze, by design, was the fire spread by the pitch-laden torches at the end of the building nearest the door. Confused cries came from inside, muted by the thick walls. The sleeping soldiers scrambled to their feet. Richard checked that the men with the heavy gates were coming. Then he ran around the sleeping house to the second building. Jensen, following close behind, handed him an arrow, the flames around its head, wrapped in oil-soaked cloth, making a whooshing sound as he ran. One of his men pulled the torch from the stand outside the building where the guard Richard killed had been patrolling. Richard leaned in the doorway only to see a big man charging at him out of the dark interior. Richard pressed his back against the door jamb and kicked the man squarely in the chest, driving him back. Richard drew the bowstring back and shot the flaming arrow off into the interior. As it lit the interior in its flight through the building, he could see that some of the men had been awakened and were getting up. Turning to take the second flaming arrow from Jensen, he saw smoke pouring up from the first building. As soon as he drew string to cheek and loosed the second arrow, he leaned away and men heaved the torches in. One torch fell back out of the doorway. It had bounced off the chest of a man rushing for the doorway to see what was happening. The pitch from the torch caught his greasy beard afire. He let out a blood-curdling scream. Richard kicked him back inside. In an instant, men by the dozens were racing for the door, not only to escape the burning building, but to meet the attack. Richard saw the flash of weapons being drawn. He sprang back from the doorway as the men carrying the heavy section of gate rushed in. They turned the gate sideways and rammed it in under the eaves, but before they could bring the bottom down to wedge it against the ground, the weight of bellowing men inside crashed into the section of gate and drove it back. The men carrying it fell back, the weight knocking them from their feet, the gate landing atop them. Suddenly, men were pouring from the doorway. Richard's men were ready and fell on them, driving the wooden weapons into their soft underbellies and snapping the handles off as man after man spilled out of the doorway.